Katrina is that we tend to see the public debate is being forced through these ideological filters, which then completely blur what's really going on to the point that people cannot get a grapple on it.
Yeah, well, it's basically built on the postmodernist assumption that everything is the same. Well, I tend to come from a modernist perspective that says that if there's no contrast, there's no knowledge. And it's not that everything is the same, it's that there are differences, and as we understand those differences, then we can gain understanding. So, for instance, you know, you'll often hear people compare the book of Joshua with some of the more violent sections of the Quran and say, well, it's all the same. Well, this sort of begs several questions. First of all, is there no historical progression in the Bible? And the obvious answer is yes. You begin with a physical kingdom of God in the Old Testament, but it moves to a spiritualized kingdom, which Jesus, as the end of the Bible, says you can't establish by human hands. It's not something that human beings can create. In Islam, you move in exactly the opposite direction. In the Meccan period, Muhammad is more or less of a prophetic preacher type. But when he goes to Medina, he begins to try to establish the physical kingdom of God on earth. So Islam, progressively, is moving in the opposite direction of the Bible. And that is the important difference. You can quote out of context anything you want from either the Quran or the Bible to justify your viewpoints on the two religions. But the fact of the matter is the Quran moves in a certain direction, as does the Bible. It just so happens that those are opposite directions.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because my philosophy has always been that Islam was something that seems to have frozen at some point in the past, never went through some of the periods that the West did or even the Eastern Church. And as a result, that's what you're looking at. For example, Islam only learned to behave itself and develop a flourishing culture, which it did when it was finally checkmated coming up through the Iberian Peninsula and also coming up through the Balkans. And at that point, things sort of stabilized out and they had to make do.
Well, actually, if you go back earlier, the initial Islamic invasions, which conquered all of the Middle East, all of North Africa, all of Spain, all of Iran, all the way to the borders of India, all within a 100-year period, it was a fantastic advance. And it was militaristic. It's obvious that Islam was a militaristic system to establish the kingdom of God by military force on earth. I mean, that's just Islam is the only world empire in world history established from the beginning on the foundation of a religion. No other empire was ever set up like that. As it were, they conquered the most valuable parts of the world and became, what shall we say, overwhelmed by their success. They had all of the money, they had all of the riches, they had all of the trade routes. The reason they didn't push on into Europe after that was Europe wasn't worth anything. Europe was a mass of cannibalistic barbarians. So Europe was left to Christianity because Europe wasn't worth anything. Then, with that money and that development, they were able to build a civilization that was quite remarkable.
Views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw, hosting tonight with my co-host Roy Avila. I've been gone for a couple of weeks, and boy, they were great shows. I was able to hear them both last week while I was in Chicago. And boy, oh boy, did I get a lesson on smart growth when I was toured in Chicago. That takes Santa Cruz and makes us like we're just beginning babes in the woods. I tell you, something about Chicago politics has brought this way ahead of the rest of America when it comes to smart growth dynamics. But that's a story for another night. Last week, boy, what a great show that was. Water and the Lost Liberty Hotel, and that discussion you had with Joanne Nathan on how USSR urban planning in the 1960s is so smart growthish.
Oh, and it's happening right now, today, everywhere. And by the way, when you were in Chicago, how did you listen to us?
On the internet.
There you go.
So there's no reason, if you're out there listening and your good friends and relatives can't hear because they don't have an AM or FM station or they don't have a shortwave, well, just about everybody these days can catch us on the internet. So don't forget about that. Tonight we're going to have an exciting show. Second hour is going to be with the one of the contributors to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz War on Reason series. If you don't have that, check into our archives. You can order the 8-CD set from us at a reasonable price and listen to it in the car. And we're getting an increasing rave review on that, Roy, and orders are starting to pick up. And there's just a cohesive, coherent expression there coming from six different people and looking at the real issues of the day. But Robert Theobald, one of the contributors to that, will be our guest in the second hour tonight. We're going to talk about regionalization of Great Britain more fully and the public-private partnerships that are emerging between British corporations and the Chinese, which have the effect of furthering British government objectives to create a one-world cabal of insiders re-engineering humanity into workforce drones living in echo villages. We're going to talk about Chinese echo villages in the second hour. But here in this first hour, we're going to, our special guest is Mr. Patrick Wood. Patrick is the editor of the August Review, which has quite a history and is back for public consumption here in the year 2005. With Patrick, we're going to talk about how Americans are increasingly becoming concerned about political globalism. We're going to ask the question, is political globalism coming to America or is it already here? Patrick, the editor of August Review, will discuss the Bank of International Settlements. Now, if you've not heard of that organization, you don't want to miss this hour. It's a little-known world central bank that directs international finance and national central banks. Well, what does the existence of such an organization mean for ordinary Americans and the future of American independence? Well, Mr. Wood's going to be with us tonight. He asked the question, if you are thinking that the global elite have somehow been pushed back and that America is now okay, think again. The elite has made virtually unhindered progress toward its own selfish and paternalistic goals throughout the Reagan and Clinton administrations, and now George Bush continues the tradition. So when we return here in a few moments from our break, we'll introduce Patrick Wood and begin tonight's show.
We're ready to take notes.
We're back here. Some of our commercial stations will be taking a break for advertising, but we're going to start in right now with Patrick Wood. Patrick, are you with us?
I am, and good evening, Michael.
Well, it's good to hear your voice. You're a former Northern California, now living in Idaho, as I understand.
Absolutely right. I was born and raised in Northern California, and just recently fled the state. No, well, not really, but we decided we'd try something different.
Well, how have you found that experiment?
We love it up here, actually. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. There's lots of things to play, lots of outdoor activities, lots of lakes and rivers and game and, you know, just activities and stuff. It's very nice. And we get four seasons up here, too, which California's not too strong on. so we get a really good fall and a really good winter. And springtime is spectacular.
Well, I'm going to share with the audience, I came across your name. I know your name has been around for a good while, and researchers and watchers of the globalist movement have known your name for decades. But I came across the article on global banking, the Bank for International Settlements, at News with Views here a month or so ago, and found that article fascinating, and digging deeper, strikes me that you have a pretty clear vision of how it is that the so important financial aspect of this New World Order remake of American society and of world cultures is done. And it's a marvelous article to read, and I'm looking forward to this discussion so that our listeners can get the essence of how it is we're being restructured from a banking and financial perspective, and what that's going to mean for America and Americans.
You bet. I don't know if you realize our research has roots in Santa Cruz. Did you know that?
Well, I did. Your former partner, now deceased, Anthony Sutton, would have lived right below us from our view here at Radio Liberty in Soquel Foothills, right down on to Aptos.
Absolutely. So it's kind of like coming home again, except I've only visited there a few times. But as far as the research goes, it's kind of interesting that was a hotbed right there that started all this for us.
Well, you know, and it's the hotbeds that always in our work and the response we get tremendous responses from states like Wisconsin and Oregon, states that are deeply rooted in the globalist activities at the local level. And where it's most deeply rooted is where we find the best response.
Yeah.
Now let's hold for a second. Our audience is going to return with us in just a moment.
You bet.
Well, welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw with my co-host Roy Avila, and we're here with our special guest Patrick Wood of the August Review. And we've introduced Patrick here in the break. In essence, we're just really beginning to get to the issue of international finance and banking systems, and how it's being organized by a cabal, an elite that seeks. In your writings, you say they seek first greed, and secondly, it's a lust for power.
Well, that's putting it real simple, understandable terms. But when you get right down to it, that's what moves these people. That's basically what's moved these type of people for, 200 years in this country. The desire to establish monopolies, and other types of cartels and stuff for the sake of financial advantage, has always taken advantage of the people. And, it's very selfish. It's very, very personal. And, it's very paternalistic, as well, because they really don't care what the people think. It's what they want to do that counts.
And yet, as I view the unveiling of this, there are really at least two legions that come out of this kind of cartelization, a paternalistic cartelization of the global economy, and that is their left-wing advocates and their right-wing advocates who really combine to deliver to society the goals of this paternalistic and greedy cabal that pretends to be diverse and tolerant and maternalistic.
Exactly so, and it can be demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that the difference between Republican or Green Party and Democrat, it doesn't matter what party you put on it, these people are above every party, but they're also in every party. And I liken this to a hijacking in one sense, because that's kind of their favorite technique of taking over an organization for their own purposes. They basically long ago hijacked both parties and took over the core. And even though there's social differences between Democrats and Republicans that are noticeable, right at the center of it, you see this group of people that are just marching to their own drum, and it has no reference to parties whatsoever. And it's interesting. You can see a George H.W. Bush on the as a member of the Trilateral Commission, and right sitting right next to him and kibitzing over over the globalization issues is Dianne Feinstein. Talk about two odd peas in the same pod. And of course we could throw in Bill Clinton. He was a member of the Trilateral Commission as well. Most all of these people are the ones that started this globalistic, this move to globalization about 30 years ago. And they have just marched on. And, you know, people out in the street unfortunately think that, you know, Democrats and Republicans are fighting each other. And indeed they are, because as long as they're fighting each other, they're not going to see the people who are really pulling the chain.
Well, that's right. And those who you know, if you're at the top, your goal is to divide, confuse, and create dependency. And
exactly.
Over the last 50 years, they've done a tremendous job of doing just that.
Exactly. And they're still doing it. It's getting even worse today.
Well, let's talk about the Bank of International Settlements. I think that's an entity that very few people have ever even heard of.
Yes.
And as you begin to study it, you can't imagine a more important political, economic institution for purposes of driving, a world politic.
Exactly. Well, the Bank for International Settlements is the oldest international financial group or organization in the world right now. They were founded in 1930, and the original beginnings of the Bank for International Settlements is really there was a lot of there was a lot of bad people around at the founding of the Bank for International Settlements. It ostensibly started out with as an organization to make clearing payments from reparation payments that Germany was supposed to make from World War I to pay back the countries that it conquered and made trouble and stuff. And these reparations payments were supposed to go through the Bank for International Settlements. That was pretty much a sham, though, because the whole organization was set up by the central bankers of that day. And this bank is, they call themselves the Central Bank for Central Bankers. And if you understand the power of the Federal Reserve in the United States, which is a semi-private organization, imagine a central bank for all the central banks of the world, an incredible amount of influence. And so when the Bank for International Settlements was set up in 1930, it was set up with incredible power to manage the activities or oversee the activities of all the central banks of the world. And one thing about globalism that we talk about globalization, one thing that we need to remember, that globalization is not just America. We write a lot about America and its impact on America, but we need to remember that it's a global thing. It's a worldwide thing. And what the Bank for International Settlements has done is given the globalist movement a glue that binds, if you will, to manage all the currencies and the currency exchanges and the flow of international capital throughout the world. It's an incredible organization.
You mean Alan Greenspan isn't maybe as important as the press lays him out to be?
Well, let me tell you, Alan Greenspan has been automatically, because he's a chairman of the Fed in the United States, has automatically been a member of the board of directors of the Bank for International Settlements all these years. And he has traveled at least 10 times a year to Basel, Switzerland, to attend these board meetings that are carried out in complete secrecy, by the way, to discuss monetary policy for the world and all the various components in the world. When Ben Bernanke takes over Greenspan's position, he will assume that board of directors seat. There's only a few board of directors for the Bank for International Settlements, by the way. It's not an extremely large board, but they represent most all of the major central banks in the world. There's a few countries that are not a part of it, but they don't amount to much anyway. But the board is makes basically all the decisions. So if you slice up the power eight ways, say in the board of directors, Alan Greenspan is a very important man in the world of finance, throughout the world. He's not involved just with America. He's also involved with making policy decisions for all the other countries in the world as well.
Now, what would you respond if someone said, well, gee, the Bank of International Settlements is necessary to effectuate the finance necessary to bring fruit to North America in the wintertime, to be able to conduct the kinds of truly positive trade events that go on in the world, and that without the Bank of International Settlements or a similar organization, we wouldn't have the mechanisms necessary to affect those kinds of advantages.
Yeah, the historical evidence on the founding of the Bank for International Settlements, and also its operation for its first 10 years until after, or 15 years until after the Second World War was over, is that the Bank for International Settlements was at least to the extent of 50% founded by members of Hitler's Nazi Party. And from 1930 until after World War II was done, 80% of the shares that were issued from the Bank for International Settlements were owned by members of the Axis countries, and that is the, you know, Hitler's alliance. And it was there was just a tremendous political stink during World War II, and for the first, like, you know, 5 years after World War II, during the Nuremberg trial, that the BIS was totally persona non grata in politics and with people in general, because it was viewed as a Nazi-dominated organization. And it lost that stigma after World War II, and it kind of recovered from it, and you know, from the bad stigma, and it took on an air of respectability in the world. Of course, you know, now the Nazi Germany doesn't exist anymore, but its foundings were very sordid indeed. Some of the people that were founders of, by the way, of the Bank for International Settlements actually spent time in jail as a result of the Nuremberg trials. And so, you know, today we have this group of people that are operating completely in secrecy. They have the most unusual relationship with Switzerland, which is where they're based, Basel, Switzerland, in that their charter allows for them to have the status of a nation state. They have complete sovereignty. Even the Swiss government officials cannot enter the Bank for International Settlements building in Basel, Switzerland, except that they're invited to come in. And it doesn't matter what the issue is, they cannot come in. The bank has its own police force. It has its own little governing body, if you will. And whatever goes into the Bank for International Settlements, when those bankers walk in, the board of directors walk in, nothing comes out that they don't want to come out. They're completely sovereign. They're immune from the law. They have no auditing standards. They have no requirement to. In fact, they refuse to allow any outside organization to audit them whatsoever. They are a private bank owned by the individual central banks of the world. It's an amazing organization.
Is there anything equivalent that you can think of in the world anywhere that is sovereign from all governmental authority?
I can think of none.
None.
I can think of none. Honestly, I can think of none. And it's interesting, some people might argue, well, it was just Basel, Switzerland, you know, because for whatever reason, you know, Switzerland has always been kind of the privacy place, you know, privacy country in the world. Maybe it was just Switzerland that allowed this kind of a contract to take place. However, the Bank for International Settlements has had extension branches in Mexico and China, and there, it shares, in those countries, it shares exactly the same sovereignty that it shares in Switzerland. So those countries where it puts these branch offices, including mainland China, communist China, those countries are honoring the contract that Switzerland made originally with the Bank for International Settlements, and they have exactly the same immunity from any prosecution that they had as if they were in Switzerland. They travel, by and large, you know, in whatever they want, whatever, they can move between countries and so on. The countries can't touch them, basically, no matter what they do.
So if they commit a crime, I mean, if objectively any reasonable person would say...
Well, yeah, here's the big question. That's right. Are they committing any crimes? I'm not saying they're committing any crimes necessarily. However, history tells us they committed plenty of crimes back during that time.
Wow. We'll be right back. Freedom 21, Santa Cruz. We're going to continue our discussion through a break that some stations take with our special guest, Patrick Wood. Well, it's phenomenal then. We've got one top business organization that operates on a worldwide basis, with their hands on the money of in the currency of all of its member countries, and that's most of the countries. And they're immune from criminal investigation. They're immune from... searches or seizures or responses. They have no auditing requirement. What is it that they do, and how is it that they're operating on a global basis that has an effect on people living in Santa Cruz or in Flint, Michigan?
Well, the role that they've assumed, of course, is a global role, not a local role. But, for instance, I'll give you a first example, and then we'll come back to the United States, and we'll bring it back down just even to our local communities. One of the great, if you will, coup de grace of currency integration in the last, 20, 30 years is the creation of the euro. That's the currency of the European Union. And, unifying the European bloc into a single currency. The reason they do this is because currencies have always been associated very tightly with sovereignty issues. And some of your listeners might remember the famous currency expert, Dr. Franz Pick, of several years ago. He wrote a gem of a little quote: "The destiny of the currency is and always will be the destiny of a nation." And so by manipulating currencies, first, the BIS is tearing down national borders and national sovereignty issues between countries, and that's exactly what's been done with the euro in the European bloc of countries and the European Union.
And of course, trade policy in the World Trade Organization plays a huge role.
Well, that's part of it.
Well,
of course, money is necessary for trade, and that's where the tie-in is. You know, without money, without the control of currencies, there'd be no trade at all. On the other hand, you could say, well, they could have control of the currency. Maybe there wouldn't be this international trade going on. The two, in fact, work hand in hand together. One needs the other just as much, but who has the upper hand? If the more study you do of the Bank for International Settlements, you realize they have the upper hand on this because they are the central bank to all the central banks, major central banks in the world. Well, coming from Europe now, what the next thing on the target list for the Bank for International Settlements is the Americas. And the intent right now, pretty clearly from their writings and just using some common sense, The intent that they're pushing for is to unify the American continent countries, first Canada, United States, and Mexico, and then also, and that's through the North American Trade Treaty, and then also the Central American and some South American countries as well, and Latin America. And the intent, the way they plan to do this, at least to congeal it, to bring it all together, is by the creation of a new currency, a regional currency here in America, that will be called the Amero, A-M-E-R-O. And the Amero will be very similar to the Euro in Europe today. And, this is the way that they're going to finally pull all this together by talking somehow, working with the governments, whatever, to cause the individual governments of a country to give up their currencies in favor of converting them into the euro, which will be a regional currency.
Hang on first a minute. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show, and our guest Patrick Wood has been explaining how the plan of Bank of International Settlements and international financiers generally has been to create regional currencies, the liking of what we see in Europe with the euro, because that way they're able to destroy the nation's sovereignty. You break down the borders of the nation if you take control of their form of money. And the plan now at BIS and with the rest of the globalists, their next mission is the creation of what's called the Amero. If I pronounce that right, Patrick?
That's correct.
Well, the Amero, which would be the North American or the Americas currency in substitution of the dollar and the rest of the nation's currencies that are here. How far along is that plan? I mean, obviously the trade agreements, two of them are now in place and they're going for a third and final one, but where are they with respect to the currency breakdown?
My guess is, and this is just my guess, that we're probably 18 months to 24 months out from where it can actually be introduced and where it'll stick.
What do you have to say about that, Roy?
Well, right now, my tongue has been hanging out for the, I don't know, how long the show been going on, for 25 minutes. It's like walking into a classroom and just having your mind filled with all this stuff that sounds like fiction. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a bad movie.
Well, you know, we're getting the habit here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz of telling basically the same bad movie from all around the Mulberry Bush. So we're getting a lot of different perspectives on it. But you add it all up, it adds to one thing, and that is that we've got leadership in this country and who are marching to the orders of this cabal at the global level, and we're in trouble.
They are following these people on a global level as well. It's very clear. And watching even President Bush's actions and activities today, we see him, we see him pushing, for instance, actually pulling out all the stops to get CAFTA passed earlier this year. You see him down in Argentina lobbying for for more regional integration. You see him in China, same thing. You see the border still open with Mexico. All of this, and with Canada by and large too, all of this stuff, you look at it and scratch your head, what on earth is this about? Well, it's perfectly understandable if you understand it from the standpoint of the power elite that are moving and shaking in the world. The result of all this is, I have to say, is that it's going to do the same thing to the rest of the world that is done to the United States in the last 25 years. The United States has virtually been bankrupted in the last, actually, 28 to 30 years. Since 1973, when the Trilateral Commission was formed to be, I look at them kind of like the Navy SEAL organization. David Rockefeller, who founded it with Zbigniew Brzezinski, realized that he wasn't going to get a global plan pushed anywhere through organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations and so on, because they were just local to one country, to one continent. He created a global organization to basically, launch this whole policy thing into a global basis. And this is exactly what they've done. But in the meantime, the United States has been sucked dry. It's like a giant mosquito has stuck their giant, proboscis into our treasury, into our national debt, into our trade deficit that's going on right now. We're getting gutted. Our guts are being sucked out by this, by this whole globalization thing. And they continue to tell us that everything is okay. It's going to work out. It doesn't matter that we have a $1 trillion trade deficit in a year. It doesn't matter that we have $800 million deficit, a spending deficit in government. Well, I'll tell you what, it does matter. But what they've done to us now, their next step is to take that economic policy, if you will, and foist it on the whole world. What they sucked out of America in the last 30-plus years, they will now proceed to suck out of the rest of the world as well. The result is going to be a lot of very, very unhappy people around the world. I mean very unhappy. I mean, these are the things that wars get fought over historically. Not predicting a war, by the way, but I'm just pointing out, this is, when you get a lot of unhappy people where they realize that they've been plundered, they tend to get a little testy.
Well, we talk at the beginning of the hour here about how the motivation is greed and a lust for power. Greed first. Now, the emerged capitalist system, which in the terms of sustainable development language, is the conversion of our economy into public-private partnerships. And these partnerships, these global corporate arrangements, have been building, and now they're building to a real high point. Now, when the system, if the system has a hard time swallowing its medicine and implodes, the greed's not going to be very satisfied. It would strike me. When we come back, let's talk about how it is that that the globalists plan to massage their way through this matter.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. After spearheading efforts to implement the United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda in Santa Cruz, California, Congressman Sam Farr wrote,
"I am writing to congratulate you, the Advisory Board, and the Action Santa Cruz County Coalition for completing the local Agenda 21 Action Plan."
Congressman Sam Farr then wrote,
"The local Agenda 21 Action Plan not only has local significance, it also will have regional and national impacts. As you know, the President's Council on Sustainable Development is beginning Phase 3 of its work, with an emphasis on sustainable communities."
Sam Farr continued,
"I have been spearheading a similar effort to develop a process of sustainable development planning for the entire region."
So why does Sam Farr now say he's never heard of United Nations Agenda 21?
Yes, Congressman Farr, I'd like to my name's Daniel Beckett. I'd like your comments on the United Nations Agenda 21 program that you're implementing here. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But you endorsed it, sir. I have your paperwork.
United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda 21. If there's nothing to hide, why does Sam now deny it? This has been a public service question posed by Freedom 21 Santa Cruz at freedom21santacruz.net, inviting you to advance the cause of freedom in the 21st century. For more information about how you can advance the cause of freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
We're back here at, for some stations anyway, at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. Some other stations will be joining us in a minute. But before we broke, Patrick, the question becomes, what's really in their game plan? I mean, it strikes me that they are feeling vulnerable, that the financial system that they've set up, they feel vulnerable about, and yet they continue to press for this globalization program, which is what's creating the vulnerability, certainly in my view. What happens to their greedy instincts if this thing begins to implode?
Well, that's a good question. Similar groups of people have survived through two world wars, through depression, through other turmoil that's been in the country, other types of crisis, and so on. And they seem to have survived quite well over a period of time. During World War II, for instance, while Germany was just completely running amok in Europe, the Bank for International Settlements just continued on business as usual all through that time. Even with participation of Western banks that belonged to the Bank for International Settlements, they rose above the whole conflict and made out like bandits on both sides, actually, before and after the war. So you have to figure that even though we're going to suffer if there's an implosion, don't necessarily bet that it's going to hurt them a whole heck of a lot, because they're sitting above the whole thing and they've got insulations that you and I don't have. We never will have it, by the way, down here at the bottom of the pyramid. But they do. They're able to create money out of thin air right now. There's not one currency in the world that, by the way, is tied to gold anymore. It's all just fiat currency, paper currency. And even the BIS itself, which up until 3 years ago used the original gold Swiss franc as its reserve asset, it recently abandoned that and adopted the IMS currency, the International Monetary Fund's currency, called SDR, stands for Special Drawing Rights, and the BIS adopted this soft currency, this basket of currencies, as its international reserve currency. So there's nothing but paper in the world today.
So we got a paper house built on top of a paper house.
It's a paper house built on top of a paper house, and they own the printing press, you see.
Well, but if inflation, hyperinflation takes off, that house falls apart pretty quickly. So who ends up with the hard currency, the hard assets that can be used as currency?
Well, this is a good question. This is a $64 question. I don't know if you're asking that quite yet from a position of prior knowledge, because we haven't talked about this.
No,
but,
I'm not.
I personally believe, and some of the research that we're doing right now, I personally believe that there will be a time when gold makes a return to the currency, to the reserve currency of the world. And
will that be under the control of the same cabal that controls the currencies today?
You want to take a guess?
Okay, so yeah. They've got that base covered as well.
Absolutely. You know, there's been a myth. In fact, my original co-researcher and writer, Anthony Sutton, wrote a book. He's deceased now. He wrote a book called The War on Gold in the 70s. And some of your listeners probably remember that book. It's a great book. But the idea was that the central banks of the world were constantly dissing gold, and every time gold started to take off a little bit, they would up and sell, start selling reserve gold, like the Federal Reserve in New York or the Bank of England, whatever, would start selling gold and depress the price. They've done this for a good 35 plus years, at least since 1971. And you ask the question, well, why do they make out like they hate gold? Well, they haven't always hated gold, for one thing. They instituted a gold-backed currency back in the late 1800s, and they went on and off of it a couple of times through the 1900s. Right now, we're off of it. But there's been a perception that gold has been moving from central banks, from centralized hands into the hands of the people. If we're going to sell the gold out of Fort Knox or wherever, well, who's going to buy that gold? Well, the little guys out there, people in India maybe that are collecting, jewelry. They want to make jewelry or something. Or maybe the Mideast that want something other than dollars to store their wealth in. Some gold's going out there. My theory right now is that gold has not been going to weaker hands at all in the last 30 years. I believe it's been going to stronger hands. And I think that that when the fiat currencies of the world blow up and go into hyperinflation, what will happen is that the people that own the gold will step forward and say, we have the gold necessary to put the world back together. You're going to let us do it or not? And, of course, at that point, the world is going to say yes. And that's exactly what happened in Germany after World War II, by the way. When their currency completely went kaput into hyperinflation, what happened was they ended up actually with a gold-backed currency, by the way. The people, the bankers and so on, just increased their control over the country. That's exactly what's going to happen. I think that's what's going to happen again. That's just my theory right now. I can't put a lot of teeth to that.
Well, that's been my nightmare, hoping against it, but that is not, I don't consider myself a researcher, and you're the first person who has expressed an opinion that confirms that nightmarish worry.
Well, the golden rule, I'm sure. He who has a gold makes the rules. It's real simple. But this has been true for thousands of years. So why are we so surprised today that they say that gold is not worth anything anymore and it's just a commodity and who cares? You can't legislate gold out of existence. It's always been money. It's always going to be money in the future. It's going to have a historic value that no other asset in the world has. By the way, for all the hot things we're talking about tonight, I would encourage your listeners to carefully read the article that we posted on the Bank for International Settlements, in particular at our website, augustreview.com. It's well footnoted, and if this sounds stranger than fiction, read the article first and then take our footnotes apart. And if you want to go to a library or get on Amazon.com and spend some money on books if you have to, and see for yourself if what we say is not true.
Well, I will second that reference to the listening audience. Look at the August Review
com, isn't it? AugustReview.com website.
That's correct. One word, www.augustreview.com.
And what you do there really is focus on globalist, globalism. What they're doing, how they're doing it, who they are. And
exactly. So when Anthony Sutton and I started this work back in the late 70s, we were focusing primarily on the Trilateral Commission back then because we viewed them as being this super cabal, if you will, the action planners, if you will, to foist this new international economic order. That's exactly what they called it.
Say that again. The Trilateral Commission was designed to do what again?
Their stated purpose in 1973 was to create a new international economic order.
International economic order. Now in the terms that I think our audience would understand, that means sustainable development policies, public-private partnerships.
Well, it does. It wasn't expressed that way back then.
Not then.
That's new language since the Trilateral Commission kicked off in 1973. But
the policies reflect the same thing, and the language is simply new. It's been managed and marketed so that they know what can sell to the average guy, and they can get the local people down here doing their dirty work, because suddenly you've got to build sustainable standards, which
yes.
Which really squeeze out everybody but government's chosen people. And as you said in an off-the-air conversation to me, when the head is rotten, the body starts to become decrepit as well. And
right.
What we've got are decrepit bodies here at the local level that are reflecting this. I keep thinking here in Santa Cruz back to the global-to-local bumper stickers that were all over 15 years ago, and
yes.
That's precisely what we've got. And the way that comes out to the local level is sustainable development policies, smart growth, wildlands project, etc. And all this stuff does start to fit and tie together. Now, who were the people? And you write that it's a collaboration of corporate, political, and academic interests that formulated the Trilateral Commission. Tell us a little bit more about those early days of the formation of the.
Well, the two people that put it together, double-handedly, were David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was an academic at the time. But the two of them, obviously, they hit it off. Brzezinski was a heavyweight academic, and of course, David Rockefeller was one of the richest men in the world at the time, and controller of Chase Manhattan Bank.
And today he's one of the leaders of the Earth Charter movement,
the
Sustainable Development Bible, if you will.
That's right. They're still around. The whole family is just still firmly embedded in the same, just where they've been for the last 100 years, actually. And they picked 300 people from around the world to be members in the Trilateral Commission. It was not a super secret organization. They did publish some white papers along the way, and made their in gobbledygook language, of course, but they made their intentions quite clear. We sifted their writings very carefully back then, and even debated them in public forums on those things. And it was kind of like, if you can imagine, debating Alan Greenspan. You could ask him a tough question. In a thousand years, you never get a straight answer. It's gobbledygook language. It's speaking in circles, speaking redundantly. It's like, what did he say? But these people have had a policy, have had a goal when they first started, and they brought people from the United States, from Japan, and from Europe together, roughly one-third for each area.
Is that why it's called trilateral?
That's why it was called the trilateral, versus, for instance, bilateral. This is a trilateral commission. It was not a government commission at all, of course. It was just, a private. Great name, though, isn't it? It makes you think, it must be something for the government.
Yeah.
But the problem was, as they started out, there was less than 100 United States members. And they were some of the most powerful people in the world. One of the first members that Zbigniew Brzezinski picked was Jimmy Carter. And through very careful grooming, they launched Jimmy Carter into the presidency. When Carter was actually assumed was installed as president, he brought no less than 18 of his fellow Trilateral Commission members into the government of that day. It was
absolutely
it was incredible, including Brzezinski. And he sucked them into government. just like a super electromagnet or something would suck up a bunch of thumbtacks, you know, off the ground if you turn it on. And ever since then, the Trilateral Commission has had control of the executive branch in the United States. Now, the problem with this, some people say, well, what's wrong with that? That's where all the good people are, and why not get good people? You know, if they happen to belong to the Trilateral Commission, so what? Here's the problem with this. The Trilateral Commission, from day one, had plenary meetings in different parts of the world where all 300 of these people got together and discussed economic policy. A lot of those people belonged to high-level government, you know, they were in high-level government positions, like, you know, presidents, premiers, and, you know, chancellors, and so on. Well, when policies were set, and then the individual countries went back, contingents went back to their own country to implement this, seems to me that there's, I mean, think about the conflict of interest here. 300 people voting for what's going to happen in America, potentially. 300 people, 200 of them are outside the country, 100 belong to us. Who's gonna carry the vote here? It's not America. What's gonna carry the vote is what the global good wants to do to America. So these people implemented policies from day one that they completely did an end run around our legislative process, around our Congress, our executive branch, our judicial branch, our rule of law. They did a complete end run around it, and we, you know, very few people saw that as, you know, at least in the public media and so on, saw that as a problem. It was a huge, huge conflict of interest, and it was a huge travesty of justice. Yet they pulled it off with aplomb.
Well, you know, it's similar to what we talk about a lot when you get down to the state and county and local levels. We find unelected, self-appointed people establishing councils. They like to call themselves stakeholder councils. And they go around and they make laws that affect everybody in the community, and the community has no idea what's going on. And there's something wrong here, because you bring business and sometimes some governmental agencies and academia, just like the trilateral model was, together to create water policy for a multi-county jurisdiction by people who are not elected, really in the insult of the people who are elected, and completely behind the curtain to the average citizen. And all of a sudden you end up with global water policies or regional air boards or loss of control on local education, and gee whiz, America sinks lower and lower. But it's that head, you know, that,
yes,
that began this then, and it's now
it
permeated
is.
our entire social and political and economic structures.
And the proverb that I quoted to you, not proverb from the Bible, by the way, just a proverb in a general sense, was a fish stinks from the head down. And when you set an environment and leadership that the little people can follow, you know, when you set a role model up there, if you will, that's a good role model, little people will follow the good stuff. If you put a role model up there that's, you know, that's kind of seedy, the little people down at the bottom will do seedy things, just like they imitate. That's all they can do at the local level. So when we say that the fish stinks from the head down, for instance, you take for instance, what, you know, a good example of this, I think, is probably Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton redefined sex. You know, well, what does is mean? You know, it's like, he redefined it to where, you know, well, it's okay to, you know, to somehow, as my personal, it doesn't matter anything, it's okay to have oral sex. And of course, we're not going to talk about it, get off of that, but here's the thing. An entire generation took a key here. They said, wow, if the president can do it, we can do it too. So what happens when these globalists in government, in powerful government positions, you know, kind of get up there and they do their role model thing with all this globalist gobbledygook, the little people down at the bottom that have, you know, so maybe just a little power, they get encouraged and emboldened to do the same thing. And guess what? They do, because they have the opportunity, they have the power, they have the platform to step in and do those kinds of things. And so we see all these little, you know, these cockeyed things that trickle down. I kind of look at it as trickle-down socialism. Starts from the top and it trickles down. Unfortunately, it's, you know, most of it's pretty stinky. It's kind of like more like, you know, raw sewage than it is anything that's good for the little people.
Well, and really, the adverse effect of it all is on a delayed timer.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that clock is ticking. And of course, that's why we do this show at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, is to bring people like Patrick Wood to our audiences. And we post our shows on the Internet. And if you missed the first part of this, you can either order a CD or catch it on our archives at freedom21santacruz.net and go to our radio section. We'll be right back here shortly with the last few minutes of the first hour of our Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. Welcome back, Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show, for our last few minutes with our special guest, Patrick Wood of the August Review. That's augustreview.com. Check out some strong research and great writings that'll help you fill in the pieces to this puzzle. You know, Patrick, once you get down to it, this puzzle really isn't that complex, is it?
It's not complex. And What my goal is with the August Review is to take the complex and make it simple for people to understand. There's very few people in the world that are writing about the big picture on globalism and putting any teeth to it. And you know, what my goal is with our website is to take the research we have, put it into simple terms that laymen can understand, and give them the whole balance of things so they see the big picture. It's not difficult to understand when you look at it from the top down. If you look at it from the bottom up, it's very difficult because, you know, there's just all kinds of junk going on.
There's so many fingers.
So many fingers to it. But we need to see it from the top down. And that's the only way, by the way, I think we're probably ever going to stop it. The resistance has to be against the people at the top, not at the bottom.
Well, in the list of Trilateral Commission members, you've got, back in 1973, the chairman and president, senior partners of Wells Fargo, Lehman Brothers, Bank of America, Wachovia Bank, Chase Manhattan, Brown Brothers Harriman. You really do have a consortium of central banking interests.
Absolutely. The banking cartel, if you were, cartel is probably the wrong word to use here, but the group of international banks have dominated the Trilateral Commission, they've dominated the BIS, and they've dominated all the central banks in the world. Now, you know, put two and two together and connect the dots.
Well, it says that the guys who've found themselves in that position want to gain control over the resources of the world, including the human beings.
Oh, yes. Alan Greenspan, by the way, was a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Well, that's
so was Paul Volcker, who was the former chairman of the Federal Reserve.
And of course, those are the guys credited with reversing the abuse of their predecessors, who delivered us the 70s style inflation.
That's right.
And yet, they're guys eating from the same cup of directorship.
That's right.
And it's like this war in Iraq, whether it's Clinton or Bush. Wouldn't have mattered. You could reverse their positions. You get the sense the directions come from on high, and you know, one bombs the installation and the other invades the country. But that was a question of timing more than the personality involved, because they're all being directed through this centralized dominating force.
Yes, indeed.
Wow. How does we're coming right up. I missed that one.
I know, it's so good, it's hard to stop, really.
I know.
It is. How is it that you can tie together, or how do the Bank of International Settlements, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank tie together?
How do they tie together, you say?
Yes.
Well, the interesting, we're going to have a trilogy before we're done. Writing on the IMF and the World Bank as well. Both of those organizations were set up after the BIS was set up. They operate on different purposes. In fact, the article gives the BIS article gives a little bit of a summary just on what the difference is between the three organizations. But the IMF gets all of its money from the member countries that chip in money. It's like kind of like the United Nations, but there's contributions that are made.
So we pay taxes to fund the IMF.
That's exactly right. And the IMF is the global bailout fund, if you will, that goes into countries that are going bankrupt or, you know, they want to help for some reason. They go in and they do things like debt forgiveness. They do things like, you know, loaning money to a country for certain projects and so on. They've over the years gotten so many countries in hock and the interest, you know, climbs up like credit card debt. The countries can't afford it and they end up crying for debt relief. So the IMF comes in and offers debt relief to these countries in return for muscling their political nature of the country. And they, when I say muscle, it means that they're extracting favors and they're extracting conditions for you know, for helping these countries out of a jam.
Meaning taking control.
Pardon?
Meaning taking control of their political economic.
Taking control. Another thing that they that's interesting, we're not on air right now, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We are, okay. What's interesting is that the IMF still conducts a lot of its activities in gold. And this is a little known thing. I didn't believe it until I went and read the bylaws of the IMF. I had never done that before, honestly.
Now, aren't all these guys the same group of guys?
Yes.
They just have different names for their organizations, but it's all the same guys.
That's right, same guys. You'll see in the Trilateral Commission, for instance, you'll see two or three ex-presidents of the World Bank. You'll see people who are associated with the IMF, and you'll see people associated with the BIS. It's all part of the global monetary cartel. But when you start analyzing how the money flows around, the BIS is the one that they're like the conductor at the train station who has his hand on the lever that throws the switches for where the trains go. And so, you know, if you want to put a train on a certain track, you throw the switch that way and the train goes on that track. Well, there's different trains out there in the world that are doing different things. The World Bank loans money. It raises its own money by selling public debt or, you know, public bonds and stuff. And it loans money to countries for development projects.
Meaning they print their own money.
They basically sell their own bonds, raise money, and turn around and loan money to countries for projects, for business development projects. The IMF, on the other hand, has had a different flavor and it goes after a different segment of the market. But when you get down to it, one bank, one fund is giving money to these people, you know, to countries to do development projects that are going to be developed by the same, you know, by members of the you know, like the Caterpillar tractors of the world, the John Deere tractor of the world. You know, those countries are going to take that money and go out and do agricultural development projects and so on. But when the country gets in trouble, and when the money that the like J.P. Morgan and Chase have loaned to these countries, when their loans get in default, the IMF comes along and bails them out. Wow. And the bailout is done by taxpayer money. It's the most fantastic money laundering system you've ever seen in your life. And not money laundering in a drug sense, but just money laundering. You know, the banks go out and make stupid loans to people, to countries, charge a lot of interest to them in the process. And when those loans threaten to go south because the country can't pay its debt anymore, the IMF comes along on the side and says, well, hey,
we're coming right up to the end here, and I want to thank you. We're going to have you back on again because there's a lot of this story we didn't get to tonight, and thank you so much for being with us this evening.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to the second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and my co-host, Roy Avila, is just...
I'm floored. That was just one of the most incredible hours that I have spent on this program.
Well, you know, we find those hours because there's a lot of people in this country who've been spending a lot of years really thinking and digging in, and now it's becoming that the warnings that they gave decades ago have now become clear, and so it's so easy to put these people in front of the American public and say, here's where we are, here's how we got here, this is where they're taking us, and now we've got to ask ourselves, what are we going to do? And well, that's a subject for future and
I think for people who caught it, who were fortunate enough to catch it, tell your friends, go to the f21sc.net website and we'll have it up. They can listen to it. You know, equally, I've been looking at America's Choice, Liberty or Sustainable Development, the DVD. It's equally as strong. I mean, in a few CDs, you really get what's going on.
Well, that thing is selling from a lot of sources around the country, and it's selling well, and that's comforting because as the word begins to spread, we're going to drop out of this Democrat, Republican, left, right, conservative, liberal divide and get ourselves focused on what it means to continue the American experience for the benefit not just of ourselves and our children, but really for posterity and for all humanity. Because if America goes down the route that we're slipping, the globalist route, there's going to be nothing left in the world to hold humanity up from the separation of a ruling elite and the rest of us being made into drones living in echo villages. Well, that kind of ties into this hour's topic, does it not? We've got Robert Theobald, who's been with us before, in fact was a contributor to the War on Reason series, something that you can order from Freedom 21 Santa Cruz's e-commerce section. We're beginning to grow that e-commerce section, so it's worth your look, and certainly if you don't and haven't seen the guides to understanding sustainable development, you want to read it online and presumably order some so that you can begin to distribute it and circulate it in your communities.
Well, like Patrick said, the more you know, the less complicated it becomes.
Well, that's true, and if you look at it from a macro perspective, you can begin to identify all the little fingers that are in this community, in your community, in every community in this country and increasingly even around the world. So what we're going to talk about tonight is regionalization in England. Robert Theobald is a British citizen, and England is ahead of us in this process. Tony Blair is a mainstay in the global movement. We've talked about his Fabian socialist connections. And before we get started, I'll read a quote from Tony Blair. This was made in a speech he made in 1997 to the Earth Summit Second Conference from the United Nations. He said, 5 years ago, the Rio Summit launched Agenda 21. Since then, 70% of our local authorities have been inspired to think global, act local through Local Agenda 21, but we must do more. I want all local authorities in the UK to adopt Local Agenda 21 strategies by the year 2000. Well, that's why we need to know what's going on over in Great Britain, because what they do there usually follows here. That's because we're on the same global string. So it's good to have Robert back with us to update us on where the sustainable engine in Great Britain is driving to now.
Hello. Hello, Michael, yes?
Yes, sir, Robert. How are you?
Hi, thanks, sir. I don't know where you want to start, Michael, but do you want to talk about the Echo Cities in China, or do you want to talk about the regionalization first?
Well, why don't we talk about Echo Cities in China? And my gosh, what would Great Britain and a fellow from England have to say about such far off issues?
Well, it's very very interesting because about 10 days ago we had the president of China came to London. I don't know if you picked that up in the United States, but he was over here, and we heard on the news that. He was going to sign about £150 million of the contracts with Britain, and then almost immediately that figure went up to £750 million, which is over $1 billion, I believe.
Right.
Well over. Now the Chinese president signed to have some the Airbus. Aircraft, which is the European aircraft, but the main thing that I wanted to talk to you about was the Eco Cities, because there's a company in Britain called OVARUP, and I'll just spell that for you. It's O-V-E, new word, A-R-U-P, and that's a consulting engineers, very well established. So they've got a contract to design 20 eco cities in China, and that was signed when the Chinese president was here. Now it's interesting because on the television, when you had the Chinese president there, he sat next to Lord Faulkner. Now Lord Faulkner was Tony Blair's. He used to be his roommate in his student days, and he's Blair crony. Blair made him into the Lord Chancellor, which is a very high position. So you had Lord Faulkner, you had the Chinese president, and then you had the representative from OVARUP. And I'll just tell you about one of the main one that we have here is that I've been able to check up on is Dang Tong. I don't know if I spelt it right. Dongtan, D-O-N-G-T-O-N, and it's in the estuary, or it will be in the estuary of the Yangtze River. That's just opposite to Shanghai, and it's a sustainable city. They flag it as a sustainable city to attract commerce and leisure pursuits. It's three quarters of the size of Manhattan. Now at the moment it's mostly agricultural land, and it's next to a huge wetland a wetland of global importance. Now, where all this wildlife lives, you see. So they're going to build this new city there. Now the interesting thing is, I checked up on the OVARUP website, and back in April they had a meeting. And they had a conference in Kuala Lumpur. And all kinds of people were at that conference. And it was sponsored by the United Nations Environmental Programme. The CTMC, I'm not sure what that is actually. But also, it was sponsored by European Union. And also by ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Excuse me, I've got a bad throat. So that was in Kuala Lumpur in April. That seems to be in the shop window for this Eco City project. And OVARUP has got lots of offices in the Far East, all over. They've got them in Hong Kong and Malaysia, many, many places there.
Now, OVARUP is a British engineering firm?
Yeah, they're consulting engineers, Michael. They're very, very well established. They do very, very high-profile design of very, very high-profile civil engineering contracts civil engineering contracts. That's what they're good at. They're a long established firm, but they've got into this sustainable thing. Now it's going to be now it's a partnership thing, of course, as you might have imagined. There's always a partnership thing, isn't it?
Between government and engineering firm, yes.
That's right, and it's they see it as a template for China and elsewhere in the world, and they're going to do the usual. It's going to be done in this usual way. They're going to do economic and business planning. Now, this will interest you especially. Social development. Sustainable building design, the architecture, the infrastructure, the renewable energy process implementation, the waste management, sustainable energy management, planning, urban design. That's the things that OWASP are going to be involved with.
Well, I see here that it's to include social development.
That's right.
So what you've got is a mass undeveloped piece of land, contract in China, being given to an English company to come in and stack the people in the smart growth model, and presumably assign them the jobs and make them the drones for the international corporate interests that are doing the, quote, sustainable development on a much smaller scale. We have the same thing happening here in Santa Cruz City with a little sustainable village being built out at Natural Bridges by a developer from San Jose. So on a much smaller smaller scale, you see the same dynamic, and with the social engineering fitting right into the purview, supposedly, of an engineering firm. And that's what strikes me as the most bizarre thing in the world.
This OWASP seems to be extremely well connected with the sustainable development concepts. And they've done an awful lot of work, it seems to me, to pursue these contracts. You know? And they've got the contract with China, you see.
This is Roy Avila. They're doing a lot of work. They've also founded a foundation that, after their founder died in 1988, the foundation now, his overall mission is encapsulated in his deed of trust. This is for the advancement of education directed towards the promotion, furtherance, and dissemination of knowledge of matters associated with the built environment. They pursue the objectives in acknowledgement of Sir, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, Ove's contribution over many decades, with the emphasis on the multidisciplinary nature of design and engineering and architecture. And this is what they're also teaching. Their principal focus is within postgraduate and undergraduate education, promoting new thinking and initiatives that they are likely to reach with a wide audience all around the world.
Well, that certainly is the prototype doctrinaire of the sustainable development sales guys. And whether they're selling to planning models or selling to educational dictates, that is the language you hear everywhere.
Yeah. While we had the president of China over in London, Michael, there's another interesting thing, of course, involved with China, because you've got, they had an article in the Sunday Telegraph, and it's entitled "Tony Closes Up with Tyranny." It was an article by it's referring to an article by Jonathan Mirsky, titled "A Gangster Comes to Town." Mr. Minsky, he contrasted the deferential welcome to London planned for the President of China by Tony Blair with China's record as one of the worst ruthless dictatorships in the world. It says here, among China's crimes, he cited the regime's murderous treatment of Tibetans, Christians, Muslims, dissidents and strikers. And then he mentions that they've got these execution vans. They go around doing extrajudicial executions, China. And then the other very, very disturbing thing is that China has gone in with the European Union for this Galileo global positioning satellite, and they've got a 20% stake in that. This is going to be a military thing, and it's also going to be for checking up on everything. For example, they want to put a chip in everyone's car, every car in Europe, that will be checked out by the Galileo global positioning satellite, so they can charge you how many miles you've driven or where you are in all this, you know. China's a partner in that, which we find rather disturbing.
Well, you've raised a number of points here. I mean, for me, and it's always been this analysis, you begin with the fact that Chinese government is a totalitarian government.
Mm.
People in America are flooding the Chinese government with huge amounts of our currency, and presumably from the stories that you're now telling us, that currency is turning around, buying English firms to go out and build the New World Order communist or eco village, where people are made into drones and made to believe they're second to the reptiles and amphibians that surround their living quarters, but which must be treated and revered at all times. This environmental movement becomes a religion, and the public-private partnerships becomes the way for a narrowing elite to control us all. And then you get the social justice, which is nowhere more fully implemented than in China, with the kinds of deadly inhuman policies that the Chinese government is now known for almost six decades. It's quite disturbing that British American world is falling prey to the folly that's taking us down. And trade policies that result in the building up of a totalitarian government working against their own people and potentially working against the interests of people around the world continues to happen without people taking note and without our media giving us warning and information.
Well, I will say that the British newspapers are doing a much better job than we are here in the States. I'm looking at Tuesday's San Jose Mercury News, and there's a front page article about our governor in China, emphasizing the importance of cooperating with China to better California.
Well, I think I've been talking to some of my friends about the newspapers recently, and from what I understand, Michael, our newspapers are a little bit fuller than the American newspapers. But you do have a good advantage over us insofar as you have the internet radio, which is very, very well developed. So I think that you have the edge on us there, but our press is a bit better than yours.
Well, as we talked privately, and as we talked on the last time you were on the show, it's so important to share the information and the experiences from Britain to America and from America to Britain, because the globalists have us in the same soup, and the patterns become easy to recognize, and that helps us cause a greater number of our fellow citizens in both countries to understand what we're up against as we begin to figure out what to do about it.
I just got one or two more things to say about this the Chinese thing. At the present moment, Tony Blair is the president of the European Union. As you probably know, it's every 6 months it changes. So Tony's been cozying up to the Chinese, and he's been involved with this development of the Galileo satellite, and the Chinese have got their part in it. But the new president is going to be the Prime Minister of Finland, the next one, in I don't know when it is, in 2 or 3 months, I think. Now, he's very, very concerned about that, because he thinks that this Chinese satellite, the the Galileo European Chinese satellite is going to be damaging NATO. And he's completely of the opposite opinion of Blair and that, so it seems. So there's going to be some things to watch out for there. And I've also got a report here talking about General Lance Lord. He's U.S. Air Force Space Command. He said that the Americans are planning to deploy an electronic warfare unit capable of jamming enemy satellites, you see. So I wonder which one that would be. Maybe it would be the Galileo. So that's in a recent report in one of our newspapers.
Well, sitting on this side of the ocean, I look over toward Europe, and the leader that worries me the most is Tony Blair.
Oh, he's actually we have endless newspaper reports about him, and he's an actor. Of course, actually, he went to school in the northeast of England, and you had a gentleman, you had Rodney Atkinson on Radio Liberty earlier in the year. And he went to school with Blair, and then Blair was in Blair's primary school, and he would tell you that the headmaster said that Blair was always, even as a boy, he was always calling everything into question and trying to change anything. It's a part of his nature. It's in him, and he's always been like that ever since he was a boy. And he's a play actor as well. Have you ever heard about the business? He lapses off into amazing lies. You know, for example, he said that this is a fact. He said this on television, I think it was. When he was a lad in Newcastle, he said that he stowed away on a plane going to the Bahamas when he was a lad, you see. That was what he said. But in actual fact, they said, well, it could never have happened because there's never been any plane flying out of Newcastle going to the Bahamas. And certainly not when Blair was a boy. So that was a complete figment of his imagination. And the other famous thing he said was about football. He was talking about Newcastle football team, and he was saying when he was a lad, he used to watch. I think it was Jackie Milburn, a famous footballer. He used to be sitting in the seat watching Jackie Milburn. But in actual fact, they pointed out that when Blair was a boy, there never was any seats in the Newcastle football ground. It was standing room only. So that was another lie he made. He does this all the time, Michael. He's got this streak of fantasy in him, you see, but it's dangerous.
Well, sure, it's dangerous. We've got the same sort of fantastic images that pop into American politicians' minds, and I think that's why Americans have begun increasingly to tune a lot of it out, because these people don't have credibility, and I think it's worrisome that we do tune them out, because they not only not have credibility, they have become truly dangerous for...
That really kind of brings me into something that I've been studying about the Fabian, actually, and there's a Fabian front organisation in Britain called the Federal Trust. Obviously, it's promoting European federalism, and they pointed out in 1997, from 1997 onwards, which is when Blair comes to power, they said, as the stakeholders rise in importance, the electoral turnout has declined. So people just aren't voting in the same numbers now. And that was the Federal Trust, which is a Fabian front organisation, which observed that. Okay.
Very interesting. Of course, for the audience that doesn't know what Fabians are, let's give a moment of explanation. The Fabian Socialists began and organized themselves in London back in the 1880s, and have had huge influences both in British and in American political and business life for 125 years now. They practice what they call a program of permeation and penetration and permeation. And that's how they're able to get all their fingers down to the local level. They come up with cute little ploys like stakeholder councils that you just made mention of, and which employ Fabian ideology, oftentimes by people who don't even know what a Fabian socialist ideology is all about. So they're able to conscript people into their mesh, all by fooling them on one subject or another subject, just so long as the victim, if you will, becomes a participant in one aspect or another of their formulation and objective. Tony Blair is the past chairperson of the British Fabian Social Society, so much for people who say the Fabians faded away 50 years ago. The British Prime Minister himself is a Fabian, so we can readily presume that Fabian ideology and policy has a whole lot to do in today in British politics, and I think we could contend that it is really much of the ideology that drives the entire globalist movement. You find the Fabians connected here, there, and everywhere.
Well, we're actually back, Marcus. Just twice recently, and I don't watch television very much, but twice recently I've been watching the news, and I've seen various political people making statements, and but in the background, one was Mandelson, and the other one, I can't remember the other one, but in the background were the banners of the Fabian Society. Now, I always understood that they always did things pretty stealthily, but they seem to be getting quite cheeky now. That's twice I've seen their banners on the TV. I've got a really good quote here for you, Michael, from 1943, a Fabian quote. This is from Margaret Cole, and she was the wife of G.B.H. Cole. He was a Fabian historian and an economist. This is what Margaret Cole wrote. She said, Fabians appeared in so many desirable liberal and cultural connections that they could scarcely be believed to be subversive of private property or of liberty.
Hmm. My. Well, today they, the attack on private property is clear. You can easily trace it to Fabian thought. Although it needs to be understood in a little different context than the way the average left liberal thinks of it, and that is that as Fabian ideology has evolved, it has incorporated the notion of what they now call public-private partnerships, combining business with government as opposed to simply have government be the business. That was Mussolini's plan, and it worked a whole lot better than Stalin's plan did from an economic perspective. And so that has become a cornerstone in the Fabian ideology. It's to move towards social justice and get rid of equal justice and always wrap itself in the flag of the environment. And then conduct business on through a partnership dynamic, government-private partnerships. Those who are buddies, chummy, and working toward the socialist objective can take their place as business purveyors. And we're seeing that right down to the local level. Whether you're in Chicago, as I was last week, it was very apparent, or here in Santa Cruz, throughout the country. And that's why free enterprise, and that's why the ranchers and the farmers are having a tough time in this country, is because this ideology is stealthily moving through, even if they're being bold enough to fly their banners on your TVs in England, when it comes to how it combs the countryside, how it permeates our institutions, it is very stealth indeed.
It's extremely stealthy. We've got a terrible problem here now in Britain. We've got so many civil servants now. They keep and the number of them keeps increasing all the time. They reckon that every family in this country will pay out 30 $50,000 pounds, that must be about $50,000, just to service the pension debt of the civil servants. So that's a huge sum that's round everybody's neck now, where this terrible bureaucracy, which is also that associated with the phobia, keeps permeating everywhere.
Well, here in Santa Cruz, the big story this year, one of the few outbreaks of real news that we've seen in our newspaper, is about the enormous increases over the last 3 years of government workers' pensions. And, again, I think you've said, as England goes, America follows shortly thereafter. So your warning of the increasing ominousness of that condition is something we can look forward to as well.
Regarding regionalization, which of course is a thing that the Fabians promoted right from a long, long, long time back, we're seeing that very, very much now on a local level. In our local paper, the other day, they're now talking about regionalization of the police force.
My! That's one I haven't heard here in the United States yet. I've heard of everything else being regionalized, but regionalized police force.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about it, Michael. They've got 8 regions in England, and they've got Wales, and then there's London. What they've done is they've floated some different suggestions of how they want to do this, because they always like to think that they always like you to think that you've got a choice about these matters, so they give you various possibilities. Now,
and everything is always voluntary, so long as you do what you're told.
Yeah, they will consult, and then they'll say, well, people wanted this or people wanted that, but basically. We're very concerned because at the moment we've got 43 police forces in England and Wales, and where I live it's the Bedfordshire Constabulary, and I can go up to the meeting of the committee, the Watch Committee, and I can ask a question there if I want to. The Chief Constable will be there, and various bigwigs will be in that committee, and I can stand up and ask my question. But once we've got this regionalization of the police force, that possibility is taken farther and farther away from me, and we're very concerned about that.
What do you see in terms of citizen response and reaction, and is that something that about which the populace can be mobilized to fight regionalization?
The trouble is, Michael, that when we're talking about something like this, for example, there'll be a group of people that are interested in what's happening and motivated and trying to understand about it, but the vast majority of the people, they were just getting with their lives, their jobs, and doing all the things they've got to do in their everyday life, and they won't take a lot of notice. And that's a terrible shame. We also... Okay, what we're doing is we're moving towards a national police, if you like. We've never had that in Britain.
Well, police state is much easier to administer if you centralise the police force.
It is much easier, and that's what we're very, very concerned about. The other thing, of course, just even at our local level, there's been in our local newspaper, they've been talking about the regionalisation of the fire service as well. Now, where I live in the east of England, there's 6 counties, and each one of those has got its own fire service. And if you go a fire, you ring up 999, and you'll be put onto the county fire control. And if you sort of say, well, I live in Home Farm. They know exactly where you are because they know the ground, and they'll send the fire engine in, and they'll find you. But of course, what this this vast new area that they will have an automated control, and you know, for example, in our area there must be about there must be about 20 George Street or even more than that. So there's going to be some terrible mix-ups. But this is all on the dictate on the regional dictate. You see, we've got to do it because Brussels says we've got to do it. You see, so that's a concern as well.
And what reasons are they giving you locally for doing it?
Oh, they don't give me any reasons. They just say we've got to have it because it's rationalisation and it's going to be modernisation. That's a very useful word.
Well, I'm here to say, well, we're running out of money, so it would be easier for us to do.
Yeah, that's right. They use those sorts of excuses because on planning, we always used to call it town and country planning here, but in other words. That was how it was called. But now, of course, it's called spatial planning, and that comes from a German phrase, spatial planning. We know it's spatial planning. But anyway, basically, the planning, the town and country planning, is out of the hands of my local authority. It's out of the hands of the county now. It's in the hands of the regional assembly, you see. They're the ones who dictate everything. They're the ones who dictate, where, for example, north of my town, they want to build a new development with 40,000 houses on it. So that's
are these single family homes, or are these,
I don't know how it would be, Michael, but there'll be lots of small homes, but there'll be lots of small places because one of the things of modern life is, of course, there's so many divorces now, and then you have these very small little houses like rabbit hutches sometimes, yeah, and then they build lots of those. So just to tell you that the planning is out of our hands, really. At a local level, there's nothing we can do about it.
And it's into the hands of regionalized stakeholding councils that sort of appoint themselves and authorized by Brussels. Is that
it's quite amazing. The way that the assembly is organized is quite amazing. Actually, you've got the Secretariat, which runs it, and they've got so many different mechanisms, really. They can constitute the thing how they want, really. I mean, say for example, a particular say there was a councillor from my town, from Luton, which there was, and his party in the town council lost the control of the town council to the other party, which is what happened. Now, he didn't disappear off the regional assembly. They just inducted him. They can just take anybody in there that they want to.
Just appoint him. Okay.
Just appoint him. Yeah, that's right.
It's how the federal office here, the Resource Conservation District, works. They just appoint the folks, and then they administer this huge grants of monies that come from government or from the Packard Foundation, and then they begin to change how it is that various aspects of the community are allowed to live.
It's exactly the same here. We've got the other thing I wanted to mention. There are so many things, Michael. You can go on about all these things forever, can't we? But I was thinking about when I was reading your The Freedom 21 Santa Cruz book. I was seeing how you've got this transport axis in Santa Cruz. And it just reminded me that we've got exactly the same thing here. There's an old railway that runs through our town that hasn't been used for many years. But the plan is to take up those tracks and convert it into a guided busway. You see, and this is going to be the transport axis.
I wonder if they're going to build those homes.
Well, yeah, it's going to. it's going to link up with Rose, of course. And this is the plan to. At the present moment, our district is made up of three separate towns. We've got Luton, which is where we live, which is a big one. Then there's Dunstable, which is small, and then there's Houghton Regis, which is small as well. And they've all got their own councils. But the idea is to put this transport axis right the way through the middle of it, link it up with a new development, and make it into a huge new authority for that.
Blur the boundaries.
Yeah.
That's it.
I'm sure that's a similar thing to what I read about that's happening in Santa Cruz.
Well, it's happening not just in Santa Cruz. I went to a conference a couple weeks ago, Stewards of the Range, and there was a fella from Eastern Oregon, just this beautiful idyllic valley in the middle of the Cascade Mountains, and there were plans to put them on a train. You know, 7,000 people in the county, and they're going to put a train line at a cost of millions of dollars, because even there, they want to change the form of how people operate. If we can't be mobile on our own, in other words, we lose our cars and we're all put on a train in the morning, we will then be assigned where it is we're going to go. Our jobs will be assigned. You know, here in California, Schwarzenegger has his new position, the former head of the Bay Area Council on Sustainable Development, is now his secretary for jobs, housing, and transportation, all in one department. You see, it's a one-stop shop for that individual who's been displaced with the evolving new world economy, and he shows up and wants a bowl of soup. Well, this government, with the infrastructure they're building now, will give him a room on the 15th floor. They're now talking about building 14-story buildings here in little idyllic Santa Cruz. So you get a floor way up high, and then you get down on time, you get your train ride out to your assignment in the field. And they'll take your children during the day, beginning at age, right at the beginning. You know, these are the dreams that Stalin had, but never would have imagined. But sustainable development and the accumulation of capital, and then the refocus of that capital into the privately financed, publicly controlled housing facilities that you're seeing in England and that we're now beginning to see here in the United States, is just the ticket that Stalin always imagined. And of course, the way it's being done now, it's going to be far more tyrannical than what Stalin or Mao ever imagined, because these guys are going to have the capital resources that those early communists never had.
That's very interesting you should say that, because I don't know if you've heard of Jonathan Pollitt. Have you heard of him?
No, I have not.
Well, he's got an outfit called Forum for the Future, and Jonathan Pollitt is a very, very big chum of Prince Charles. And as you know, Prince Charles goes in for the, he's a big fan of sustainability and so forth. You know.
Our good friend Joan Dion wrote a book called The Sustainable Prince.
That's right. Anyway, Jonathan Pollitt, he's got a lot of money backing him up. I went to a meeting in the City of London Guildhall last June, which was, as you can imagine, it's a splendid venue, and it must have cost them quite a bit of money to put the thing in, and it was called Regions to be Cheerful.
Wow. Yeah, the language is always a crack up. I mean,
and basically what they were saying in there was, we want the regions to be used as the vehicle to get the sustainable development in place. That's what Poet was saying. And of course it was a really kind of meeting. It was facilitated, you know, the way they fix it with the Delphi system. So they come out with the answer, they come out with the conclusion that they're done. And it was very, very slick, actually. A very slick operation. But anyway, Poet was on the BBC Radio 4 the other day, and he said, oh no, he said, you've got to realise that we won't be able to put our plans into operation unless we have partnerships with private enterprise, you see.
Well, that's the same call that Hitler made when he looked for his partners, or Mussolini. You know, this is an economic system, that Americans and British citizens need to come to understand is the perfection of what of all that could be wrong. You cannot marry government and business and have human beings operating as human beings.
You cannot. It's fascinating, isn't it? I was going to tell you a bit more about the Fabian Society, Michael.
Okay, but before you do that, let me just let our listeners know that if they've got a question or want a clarification, they can call us and ask our special guest, Robert Theobald. The number is 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, just looking at the number of Fabian Society members in the British Parliament. It says in 1919. In 1922, there were 10 Fabians in the British Parliament. In 1945, that's after the war, half the Labour MPs are Fabians. 229 Fabian members of Parliament, including 10 cabinet ministers.
These people were openly acknowledged?
Yeah. 35 under secretaries, 10 parliamentary private secretaries. So that was the power of the Fabian Society after the war, you see. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Another very interesting man that I've been reading about is a gentleman called Sir Bernard Crook. He's been involved in these Fabian front organisations. One of the early ones was the Study of Parliament Group. Bernard Crook, he's an academic and a leading Fabian, and he's been going for donkey's years, but he's still about, and the recent thing he's launched is an advisory group on citizenship training in schools for Bernard Crook. You've got a lad of 7 years old, and he goes to school, and we hear about various things that happen that they get up to in schools. But Bernard Crook, he's one of the motors of Fabianism and regionalisation. He's been involved in all that. In 1966, they had the Study of Parliament Group, which incidentally didn't have any MPs in it in actual fact, not directly in it. And they discussed regionalisation in a free and lively fashion, that's their own word. And this is in 1966. And Bernard Crook, he wrote an article in his own magazine. And he's concluded that the Treaty of Rome equated. That's the Treaty of Rome, that's the treaty that sets up the European Union. He concluded that the Treaty of Rome equated to a defined regional policy. So, back in 1966, the Fabians were getting this regionalisation lined up.
Well, it's, we've said it often here at Freedom 21, if you can blur the boundaries, starting with the political boundaries, and raid the treasury, you can gather all the riches of all the people. And that's what the globalist movement's all about. That's what public-private partnerships were intended to do. And to make any of that happen, you've got to break down the political boundaries of the two great political entities of the last millennium, England and the United States. And this regionalization program is doing just that. I think you're ahead of us, but we're moving hard and fast. Again, here in California, Schwarzenegger calls for the elimination of counties in his CPR review. That's called, I don't remember what the symbol stands for.
California Performance Review.
That's it, California Performance Review. He calls for elimination of counties, and he calls for the consolidation of all school boards into 10 regions in California. So if you think you got problems with your school districts now, imagine if it's covering 6 counties, a single school board. That would be the average here in the state of California. So regionalization is something alive and well. Al Gore in this country called it the reinvention of government. Ronald Reagan actually in this state is the guy who got it started, saying the political boundaries were horse and buggy era politics, and how wrong he was about that. But it's costing us all now, and it's going to cost us all a whole lot more in the future if this regionalization program isn't blocked.
Certainly is. We've got the spatial planning. Reading about a town in the north of England, in Middlesbrough. Now they've decided there. It's been decided that a particular quarter of the town should be knocked down, and the houses are worth £75,000. They're little houses, but you can only they put a planning order on them now to knock them down, and you can only sell your house to the authorities. And they will give you £35,000 for it. So you're £40,000 missing there. So if you want to go and buy another house in the same area, you've got to pay £75,000. Now they've actually stolen from you more than half the value of your house. Now that's a tyrannical thing that we're starting to see more and more.
Well, our Supreme Court case, Kelo versus New City of New London, is an example of that, not in the full extreme that you've just described, but that's where these things are headed. First they tell you it's not your castle, and then they tell you we're going to tear it down, and then they tell you, well, we might give you a little bit of money, but we'll decide what it is, and we'll have criteria. We have a caller on the line, Roger from Pennsylvania. Roger, are you with us?
Yes, thanks. I wanted to ask, across the pond, is the regionalism not much at all sold under the rubric of greater economies of scale? In other words, everybody's groaning under these ever mushrooming taxes and fees, and so they dangle that out, and you probably don't actually achieve any savings the first year, and right after that they go up, so that's all kind of fiction. Do you have any examples of that having worked out that way already in other areas, perhaps?
The thing that I mentioned already was the fire brigade, the fire service. They do use that argument for regionalizing the fire service. Yes, they do. And also with the police, they say, oh no, we can't handle the complexity of crime today with the resources that we've got with our local police force. We've got to have it regionalised. It's going to be more economical to do it that way.
Yeah, now here it's more like push for water and sewage type.
Yeah.
You mean in terms of the regionalization, Roger?
Yeah, that's of course it involves other things, but
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of regionalization in California, certainly, and water is clearly one of them. And regionalizing water has this effect, and it's particularly important here in the arid West. As they begin to regionalize water, it gives them all the excuses that they can begin to dream up for why it is they've got to first meter and then tax and then take. Private wells, and when no human being can tap their own way with their own ingenuity into nature's water supply, well then, by golly, somebody's all got us on a rope.
Thanks for your call, Roger.
Well, Robert, we've got a few minutes left here in the show. Are there some good things happening? Last time you were here, you talked about the Chatham House.
Good thing. Well, we've got a very lively opposition, actually, Michael, to regionalisation. One of the Labours that is very active is Jenny Sloop. I keep asking her to come in, American Radio, but she's a bit shy, she won't come in. But
keep up with her.
She does so many things. I mean, just on Wednesday they gave out 10,000 leaflets in the streets of Reading, where they were holding the regional assembly meeting. So they just flooded the town with a leaflet that they produced about it. You see,
fabulous. Does the press then pick up on those?
Yeah, the press in Reading is very, very sympathetic to us. We had a demonstration outside Chatham House, and I can, as you probably know, that is a centre of Fabianism. And they weren't at all comfortable with us being outside there. I mean, we had permission from the police to be there, but they were very, very uncomfortable with us. We had some big banners. I mean, they were quite accusatory, really. We had, our big banner said, Chatham House, where the EU-Fabian elite meet to cheat. That was our slogan there. And they were so concerned about us, they sent their photographer, their Chatham House photographer, out onto the balcony to take our photo with his powerful camera. You see?
Before we go, I have one question for your opinion on. What is it about China that everybody is so focused on? I mean, California had their governor there. Mm-hmm. Their president has come to see you. We had a big company here. Hewlett-Packard just opened a big research lab in China. What is it about China?
Well, I think that I think it's different things. I think that lots of business. I think there's a business angle where they think that where business thinks that it's got to get its slice of the action out of China. I think that many people are afraid of China, and I think that they're justified in being afraid of China. And I think that people I don't trust these natives at all, but I think that there's a fear of China, and there's also a business angle, and we know that it's an extremely dynamic country. We know that the Chinese people are highly intelligent, and one or two ideas there, Michael.
Well, thanks so much. Well, Robert, I want to thank you for getting up early while, you get us ready for our night's sleep. It's always wonderful to talk to you, and the best to you and the people you work with in England, because America is in your footsteps in many ways, and together we're going to beat this global monster.
And don't forget, a good new book out is Lindsay Jenkins, Disappearing Britain. Look out for that one. And I think you know what Lindsay Jenkins is.
Thank you very much.